Once again, good morning, and thank you very much for coming to the Arche Kala. A special thank you to Rabbi Gutenberg and to Dan Walter for their work in setting this up and running the program this morning, as well as Rabbi Heber for the shiur that he gave earlier. And as I said before, you know, we chose the topic of Shemitah because this is what our Beis Medrash is learning this year, all year long. And so I'm inviting you, the Kol is inviting you to come in and participate in something that we're doing, you know, all year, in the hope that, number one, it'll be a good Beis Medrash experience, and number two, maybe people are interested in learning Shemitah in general and will join in our weekly Shemitah Shiurim as they are able. We're going to discuss the topic of the Shemitah Esrog, which will spill over into the Shemitah Lulav and the Shemitah Hadas and the Shemitah Arava a little bit as well. What I'm going to say is not psak. I am not paskening anything. That's the nightmare slash job of your shul rabbi. So please speak with them regarding practice. What I want to deal with are three primary issues. Number one, the question of which of the arba minim, lulav, esrog, hadas, arava, which of these actually has shmita issues at all? Number one. Number two, how one purchases a shmita esrog. And number three, what happens after Sukkot is over? What do you do with your Arba Minim once Sukkot has ended? Now, one topic I'm not really going to address, Rabbi Heber discussed it this morning, is the topic of the Heter Mechira. In other words, if I take the view that I can sell my orchard to someone who isn't Jewish, and that will in fact remove its Shemitah status, that radically changes the entire picture, permitting most of the concerns that we might have had. The reason I'm not going to take that into consideration is because that will make this a very short shiur. But also because, as Rabbi Heber mentioned, many people who live outside of Israel will say, well, I don't need the Heter Mechira, and therefore I'd rather not rely on it. Whether they're right or they're wrong, being a separate conversation, but in practice, the way that esrogim are sold is as though there is no heter mechira. That's when they actually take the steps that they take, they act as though it's not being participated in. So we're going to discuss the somewhat longer topic of what you do in a world where there is no heter mechira for the lulav and esrog. So our first question is, which of the arba minim, which of the four species, might actually be subject to kedusha of shviyas, to sanctity of shemitah produce? So, in order to discuss this, we need to see source number one, which I urged people to see during the prep time, and we're going to go through it now. It begins with a Mishnah in Sukkah. And the Mishnah says, Halokach lulav mechaveiro b'shvias. If you buy a lulav from somebody else during Shemitah, nosei lo esrog b'matana. So the seller gives the buyer the esrog as a gift. L'fishein rasha lelokcho b'shvias. Because you're not allowed to buy the esrog during Shemitah. So our Mishnah, by the way, there's actually some discussion about the fact that it says one who buys it mechaveiro, from his chaver, as opposed to from an am ha'aretz. There's a whole discussion about that word and whether that word has significance. We're going to pretend it doesn't for now. But the Mishnah says the esrog has to be given as a gift. What is our Mishnah then assuming regarding the status of Shemitah esrog? You're not allowed to sell it, it has to be given as a gift? We're assuming that it's subject to the Kedusha Shviyas, to the holiness of Shemitah produce. What are we then assuming about a lulav? That you're not, because you're buying the lulav. So the Gemara's primary question is, why are you distinguishing between lulav and esrog? We're going to explore two different avenues. Avenue number one that we're going to explore, well, we'll see it. We'll walk right through it. The opening part that we're going to see is the idea that lulav and esrog have different calendars as far as Shemitah is concerned. Iachi, the Gemara asks, second line in source number one. I deliberately brought Hebrew rather than Hebrew and English in order to make it more of a Beis Medrash experience. Hopefully it'll all still be clear. Ihachi lulav nami. The Gemara challenges and says, if esrog is subject to Shemitah, then lulav is also subject to Shemitah. And the same rule should pertain. To which the Gemara answers, lulav bar shishis hanichnas l'shviyasi. We're talking about a lulav that grew in year 6 and was picked in year 7, was chopped off the tree in year 7, and it's not subject to Shemitah because its primary growth was in year 6. So the Gemara says, well, if that's that's true, then presumably the Esrog had the same calendar, because the Mishnah did not indicate otherwise. So, Ihachi, if so, Esrog Nami Bashishis Hanichnas Lishviisi. Your Esrog should also be year 6 growth that was picked in year 7. So why is it that the Esrog is subject to Shemitah, the Lulav is not? To which the answer is Esrog Basar Lakita Azlinan. Because when you're dealing with a Lulav, I care about when it grew. When you're dealing with the Esrog, I care about when it was picked from the tree. Now, this is part of a broader discussion that affects not only the laws of Shemitah, but also the laws of Meiser. And basically, we distinguish between tree fruit and vegetables. If you jump down to source number 4 for a moment, you'll see the key question regarding the status of Esrog. The way of an esrog is like a yerek. We're translating yerek as something that grows from the ground as a vegetable, although that's not really a good translation. It is for our purposes. So an esrog is like a yerek, like a vegetable. What do you mean? My yerek darko ligodel al kol mayim. The yerek grows on all water. I added the words in brackets to help. Velorak geshem, not just rainwater, but you have to irrigate. If you don't water the vegetables, they will not survive growing based on rainwater alone in the Middle East. So the Gemara says, the yerek grows based on irrigation as well as rain. Ubishas lekitaso isuro, and the rule for yerek is that you tithe it based on when it is picked. Not only when it begins to grow, that status of when you tithe it is linked to how it grows, what type of water it needs. The same thing will be true regarding the esrog. The esrog requires watering. It will not grow just based on the water that falls, even though trees normally survive that way. Tree fruit normally grows just based on rain. Esrog can't do that. Esrog needs additional water. Therefore, we're going to compare it to the vegetable and say, "Ubishas lekitaso isuro." We go based on when it is picked. That's how we determine when you're going to tithe it. Source number 4 is not a Shemitah source. It's a Meiser source. It's about tithing. Just to make sure that part is clear, because I just realized that it may not be clear. There is a tithing calendar. Okay? The rule is that when you separate Truma and Maaser, you have a 6-year calendar, right? This is the duck-duck-goose calendar. You're familiar? The duck-duck-goose calendar? Okay. So the way it works is this. Every year, when I tithe, for 6 years out of the 7 years of the Shemitah cycle, I have to separate my first approximately 2% and give it to a Kohen. That's called Truma. Right? That's it's a range, but we'll call it 2%. I then separate 10% and I give it to the Levi. That is called Maaser Rishon, the first tithe. But then there's another tithe. In the first and second years of the Shemitah cycle, of the 6-year cycle leading up to Shemitah, and in the fourth and fifth years as well, you're going to take that tithe, it's called Maaser Sheni, this additional 1/10, and bring it to Yerushalayim to eat there. Or you will redeem it for cash, bring the cash to Yerushalayim and buy food there. But it's about Yerushalayim. That's called Maaser Sheni. In the third year and the sixth year, instead, you're going to give it to some needy person. That's called Maaser Ani. Okay? For the Aniyim. So what happens is you have this duck-duck-goose cycle. Right? It's going from the first year, second year, third year, and so on. It's Maaser Sheni, Maaser Sheni, Maaser Ani. Maaser Sheni, Maaser Sheni, Maaser Ani. You follow? And then goose and whatever. That's Shemitah. That's the way that your tithing cycle works. Which means that you need to, which, if it's not clear, you have to go back to kindergarten. Which means though I need to know what year this lulav is, or not lulav, but the esrog is, or the yerek is, or whatever it is. I need to know if I have an esrog that grew in year 2. But then was picked in year 3, I need to know whether I'm doing Maaser Sheni like year 2 or Maaser Ani like year 3. Right? That's one reason I need to know. The other reason I need to know is because you have to tithe each year's produce independently. And so you have to make sure that you know which year this belongs with. Okay. But that's a side note. The point is that as explained in source number 4, when it comes to tithing, we say you go with the year the esrog is picked. rather than the year in which it grew, because it's like vegetables that grow from the ground in the way that it, that in terms of its water needs. So going back to our source number one, and the Gemara in Sukkah, the Gemara says, Esrog baser lakita azlina, and I'm going to work with when you pick the Esrog, not when the Esrog grows. The Gemara then asks a question, and it says, and I'm going to now abbreviate this this next piece here. But the Gemara says, I don't understand. We have a mission in which Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer both discuss the status of an Esrog, and they both believe that in terms of Shemitah, the Esrog follows Chanata, which is a period of its growth, its early growth, one-third of its growth. It's unclear, and there's a lot of debate about the exact definition of Chanata, but basically it's when the Esrog grows. Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer both say that as far as Shemitah is concerned, we don't go with when it's picked, we go with when it grew. And therefore, if you're dealing with an Esrog that grew in year 6 and was picked in year 7, which is what we posited, it's not subject to Shemitah sanctity. That's our question. So the Gemara answers, you're right. However, in the second bullet in source number 1, we find out that Rabosenu Be'usha, the sages, when they were in Usha, remember that the Sanhedrin moved towards the end of the second Beis HaMikdash. It moved out of the Beis HaMikdash. It went to Yavne, it went to Usha. There was a back and forth period. When they were in Usha, they said that Shemitah, that Esrog actually follows Lakita. That it we go with when the Esrog is picked, not when the Esrog grew. And therefore, if you have your 6th year Esrog that was picked in year 7, it's actually going to be subject to the laws of Shemitah because it was picked in year 7. So the opening half of source number 1, and this is the key that we need to pull out of this. The opening half of source number 1 says that if I have a lulav and an esrog, and they both grew in year 6, but were picked in year 7, the lulav will not have Shemitah sanctity, because the lulav we care about when it grew. The esrog will have Kedusha Shavias. It will have Shemitah sanctity, because the esrog was picked in year 7. Clear? But then we get to the second half of this Gemara. And this is where it says Taima, about halfway through it. What we've been saying indicates that the reason why the lulav didn't have Shemitah status was because it grew in year 6. Right? That's why we said it doesn't have Shemitah status, because it grew in year 6. The implication is, Hadishviyas, if it grew in year 7, you know what we would say? Kodesh. It would be a Shemitah lulav. It would actually be a Shemitah lulav. And the Gemara asks, am I? Why should be a Shemitah lulav? Eitzim be'almahu. It's just wood. The Eitzim ain't by Mishum Kedusha Shviyas. Wood does not have Shemitah sanctity, and they prove it by quoting you a brisa which says, Ale Kanim v'Ale Gefanim, if you have reeds, if you have grapevines, without the grapes, and you collected them into your chuba, into some like hunter's blind type area where you're amassing your wood in the field. If you did that, Lekata la'achila yesh ben Mishum Kedusha Shviyas, if you gather them for eating, then it has Shemitah sanctity. But if you gather them to use them as wood, and you're not eating your lulav, right? If you gather them, I hope, to use them as wood, ain't by Mishum Kedusha Shviyas. They don't have Shemitah status. So therefore my lulav never has Shemitah status. So why on this Mishnah are you telling me the reason why I can sell the lulav is because it grew in year 6 and was only picked in year 7? I don't care what year it grew. It doesn't make a difference. Lulav shouldn't be subject to Shemitah. So the Gemara answers, Sha'ani Hasam, no. These reeds that we talked about, these grapevines that we talked about, those are different for a very important reason. De'amar Kra, because the Torah says, Lachem yiyeh le'ochla. Shemitah produce shall be for you for eating. Lachem dumya de le'ochla. It is for you in a manner in which it is like it is for eating, by which we mean, Mishahana aso biuro shava. When you eat something, you benefit from it at the same time as you destroy it. Chewing and swallowing destroys it, and that's when you are getting your benefit from it. We have a lot of discussion about whether your main benefit is when you're enjoying the taste of it or when you're actually digesting it, but that's the principle that the Gemara sets down. When you're eating something, you are benefiting and destroying it simultaneously, as opposed to wood. The primary use of wood, as the Gemara sees it, is to burn it to create coals. And the coals will then be able to be used for cooking or for heating a room. That's your primary use of wood. So therefore, your biur, your destruction, occurs before your benefit ever occurs. You follow? So therefore, wood is not subject to the laws of Shemitah. Only if the way you benefit from it is by destroying it and benefiting from it simultaneously. So that's why the reeds and the grapevines are not subject to the laws of Shemitah. To which the Gemara then challenges and says, well, what about wood that you burn for light? Right? If I'm using it as fuel for a fire that I use for light, then in fact I benefit simultaneously with my with the destruction. To which Rava answers, yeah, but that's not the main use of wood. People usually use oil, right? Like we've been doing for the last 8 days, oil, wax, whatever you want. But we have different kinds of fuel that we use for a flame that we use for light. People don't make a bonfire for light purposes. They tend to make a bonfire for heat purposes. So that Gemara is going to be very important. Both halves of that Gemara are going to be very important for us. Number one, the first half of the Gemara, which says that for the esrog, we work with when you pick the esrog, not when it grows, when you pick it. Number two, the point that the laws of Shemitah only apply to items which you use and which you destroy and benefit from simultaneously. So, with all of that in mind, we look at the esrog. In truth, there is some discussion brought by the Mishnah's Yosef, of Yosef Lieberman, a student of the Chazon Ish. He has a discussion about whether we should have any of this concern at all. He argues, maybe, since we have set down a principle that you're only subject to Shemitah if you benefit from it and destroy it at the same time, he says, you know, we have a rule in the Gemara, mitzvos lav lehenos nitnu, that mitzvos aren't given to us for our enjoyment. It's not about any enjoyment I'm getting when I'm doing the mitzvah. I'm not enjoying it physically. Yes, I may get some reward for it. But mitzvos are above and beyond normal human pleasure. And therefore, he argues, maybe there's no such thing as hana, there's no such thing as benefit from the lulav and esrog. So there are all sorts of arguments that are brought against it. I brought you in source number two a quote from Shlomo Zalman Orbach, mostly because I liked his acronym. But Shlomo Zalman rejects this. And he says, people of course benefit from their arba minim, from the arba minim, and particularly from the esrog, when they have a nice esrog and they show it off to everybody else. That's called benefiting. And he quotes you a pasuk from Tehillim Lamed Vav. He says, the esrog is an otrikon, is an acronym for al tivoeni regel gaava. Right? That I shouldn't become arrogant. That's what esrog, aleph tav resh gimel, stands for. Al tavoeini regel gaava. So he says that that number one, aside from other arguments, he says you can't use this argument. Of course, another reason why we know you can't use this argument is if you use that argument, then that whole Gemara in source number one becomes void. Why are they concerned at all about the benefit from, or the Kedusha Shvius, the sanctity of Shemitah for this lulav and esrog that you're going to use for your mitzvah? I think you could make arguments on that, but that's one note. Argument number two for why it shouldn't be subject comes from a sefer that actually Rabbi Haver quoted before, the Mishmeres Habayis. The Talmud Yerushalmi says that an esrog that's been planted for the mitzvah has the law of Arla. The law of Arla prohibits use of the fruit of a tree within the tree's first 3 years. So an esrog that's planted specifically to be used for the mitzvah has the law of Arla because of laws that are unique to Arla, but it will not have Shemitah status if it's planted just for the sake of the mitzvah. Well, if so, maybe all of this is moot. There will be no such law. There will be no such law. However, you can't really use that argument for a couple of reasons. One reason you can't use the argument is because our esrog trees are not planted exclusively for the mitzvah. Meaning, many people take the esrogim after Sukkot is over and they make them into jam, or they make esrog liquor, or whatever they're going to do with it. It's not as though it's exclusively for the mitzvah. No one is policing that. So, well, let's assume that this is in fact a concern. Which year's esrog are we then going to be concerned about? So we saw already in the Gemara in source number one that you had two different views. One view is I care about the year when it grows. The other view is that I am concerned with the year in which it is picked. I brought you sources on the sheet, which in the interest of time I'm not going to go through inside, but you can see them for yourself. If you saw source number one, you basically saw sources three and six already within that discussion. The Rambam's view, as you see in source number 5, is that we work with when the Esrog is picked. In practice, the bottom line is, our Esrog this coming year will be in that situation because, number one, it will have grown in the Shemitah year, and number two, it's going to be picked in the Shemitah year. The Esrog that shows up in Toronto, right, sometime around Yom Kippur, was not picked after Rosh Hashanah in Israel. Your Esrog was picked during the Shemitah year. So whichever way you go, whether you go with the year it's picked or you go with the year it grew, that's going to be a concern. The only way in which it would not be a concern, the only way in which you could make an argument and say that it's not that Shemitah status is not relevant would have been last year's Esrog, and specifically last year's Esrog if you had picked it after Rosh Hashanah. So in other words, you're in Israel, and you have it picked after Rosh Hashanah, then you have a discussion. It grew in year 6, but it was picked in year 7. That's when this becomes relevant. The Chazon Ish, Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon, they say to follow both views, l'chumra anyway, to be strict anyway, which means that an Esrog picked after Shemitah in the beginning of year 7, after Shemitah started, would be subject, and the Esrog we're going to use is also going to be subject to it. So that's the basic point. What about our lulav? So our Mishnah that we saw in source number 1 clearly assumed there was no Shemitah status for a lulav. What was the conclusion, though, of the Gemara in source number 1? When the Gemara went through this question at the end of source number 1, right, it asked the question of, you're telling me the lulav is not under the laws of Shemitah because it's from year 6. But if it was from year 7, it would be subject to the laws of Shemitah, right? We challenged it and we said, but wait a minute, I have a brisa that says that wood isn't subject to Shemitah. We defeated that brisa by saying, well, that brisa is talking about wood that's going to be used for a fire. Right? Wood that's going to be used for a fire for heat. And wood that's going to be used for a fire for heat is not subject to the laws of Shemitah. So what's our conclusion as far as the lulav that's going to be used on Sukkos? Will that have the laws of Shemitah? Yes. Why? You benefit from it. Do you destroy it by benefiting from it? You're not destroying it at all, I hope. Right? I mean, maybe you give it to your kids. But yeah, Sam.
Was Rabbah's statement conclusive of that, or was it only just a side opinion?
So that's a really good question. It's not clear. Rava's statement is conclusive in terms of saying that most wood in general is used for a fire for heat, and therefore he wants to say, therefore all wood doesn't have the laws of Shemitah. That piece of it is. The question is that the Gemara's conclusion? The Gemara never closes the loop by coming back to Lulav and saying, therefore Lulav something. It doesn't actually give us the ending. So the Rambam on the Mishnah, if you flip the page to source number 8, look what he does. He says, "Uklal hu etzlenu esrog baser lechitaso azlinon." He says the general rule is that with esrog you go with when it is picked. The Kevan Shanilka Pashana Shvius, and since it is picked in year 7, Haredino Kitin Peiro Shvius, it has the status of Shemitah produce, Aval Pisha Nigmar Pashana Shishis, even if it grew in year 6. Aval Halulav Mutter Lemochro, but you can sell the Lulav, Lefishu Ke'etzim, Vein Kedusha Shvius Chala Alav, because the Lulav is just like wood, and it doesn't have the status of Shemitah. So according to the Rambam, the answer is, Rava is right. Rava is the conclusion of our Gemara. The conclusion of our Gemara is that Lulav is not subject to Kedusha Shvius. Right? That seems to be the Rambam's view. Rashi on the Gemara disagreed. If you take a look at Rashi on the Gemara in source number 9, he writes, Yatsu Ate Hasaka Shana Asan Achar Biuran, that we exclude wood that's going to be used for a fire for heat, because you benefit then after you destroy it. Mishanasu Gechalim Ofenbahen, when it becomes coals, when the wood is turned into coals, then you bake. He's actually mentioning baking, not heating the house, but it's the same concept. Avolulav, when you're dealing with a lulav, Rashi says, Ikar Hana Asa Lechabed Esabayas, your main benefit is to sweep the house. Right? Branches are not only for lulav. Right? People use branches to sweep the house. And that is when you destroy it And it's also when you benefit from it. You're using it for sweeping. That's going to ruin the branch. So, v'damilano asachila, he says it's like benefit from eating. So, in other words, Rashi takes the view that the conclusion of our Gemara is actually that a lulav is subject to Shemitah sanctity. It's a machlokas between Rashi and the Rambam. Rashi says, yes, it is subject. The Rambam says that it's not. Now, today, we don't use a lulav for sweeping. Right? I think? Is that contention? Generally accepted. So Rav Shlomo Zalman mentions this in source number 10. Rav Shlomo Zalman says, and I'm gonna, again, in the interest of time, I'm going to be stating it outside of the text. He says, even if Rashi's view is the conclusion of the Gemara, even if Rashi's view is correct, that in fact because it's used for sweeping, therefore it's subject to Shemitah, he says we don't use it for sweeping. Ah, but you'll tell me it could be used for sweeping if somebody wanted to? He says, that's okay, because no one at all intends to do it. Therefore, flat out, it's not considered a broom. It's not like when you have fruit that is edible for animals, in which some people may decide not to feed it to the animals, but it is edible for animals, and there are people who do it. Lulav, nobody does it. So therefore, Shlomo Zalman says, even if you take the view of Rashi, your lulav is not subject to Kedusha Shvias, to sanctity of Shemitah produce. So, Esrog is an issue this coming year. Lulav is not an issue this coming year, because lulav, your benefit and its destruction, are not simultaneous. Clear? Okay. What about your hadas? So the hadas has its own problems, in fact. We already said that wood does not have the sanctity of Shemitah produce. However, the Rishalmi in Shavias, which I brought you here in source number 11, has a discussion about whether things that smell nice have the status of Kedushas Shavias, of Shemitah produce, and it doesn't have a conclusion. It doesn't actually conclude anything. So there's a lot of discussion as to why this is even an issue in the first place. Does smell count as benefit at all? You know, not everybody enjoys smell in the same way. There's a lot of discussion about that. The Rambam does not quote the halacha of Shemitah regarding things that smell nice at all. He doesn't mention it in his Mishneh Torah, and some conclude, therefore, that the Rambam understands the Rishalmi in the end to be lenient. However, the Chazon Ish disagreed, and the Chazon Ish seems to indicate in Yud Daled Tes that he was strict in this regard. The Ma'aril Diskin in Yerushalayim is quoted as having been lenient regarding Hadassim specifically, because he said the Hadassim that you buy, you're really buying for the mitzvah and are planted only for the mitzvah. Others disagree, because after all, the standard practice after Sukkot is to take your Hadassim and use them for Besamim, for after Shabbos, which is a form of benefit. But in truth, Hadassim are controversial. And so the concerns that we're going to have regarding Esrogim, many will apply to the Hadas too. That's worth knowing about. The Arava, last but not least, the Arava does not have Kedusha Shvias, because the Arava really is just planted for the mitzvah, and it's wood, and it's not used to sweep your floors, and the Arava therefore does not have Shemitah status. So the upshot of issue number one is, Esrog will have Shemitah status, and specifically this year's Esrog, not the one from last year. Lulav, subject to debate, but will not, we say, will not have Shemitah status because you don't benefit from it and destroy it at the same time. Hadas is subject to debate as well, even though you're not destroying it when you smell it, unless you grind it up. Nonetheless, Hadas is subject to some debate, and in fact there are those who contend that it is subject to Shemitah status, even though it was planted for the mitzvah. And the Arava, everybody agrees, is not. So, for our Esrog, and potentially for our Hadas, what are the ramifications of saying that it is subject to Kedusha Shvias, to holiness of Shemitah? So, number one, the rule is that if something is subject to holiness of Shemitah, you're not supposed to guard it, right, to keep people out of the field or out of the orchard. And number two, you're not supposed to work it. However, and I'm making a long story short in this regard, it's not one of our main focuses or foci here today. The Rav Chaim Kanievsky in source number 12, source number 13, rules that that we follow the view that even if somebody did guard it illegally, even if somebody did work it illegally, nonetheless we are allowed to use the result for a mitzvah. So even if it was done inappropriately, that's not going to be a concern of ours. We're also going to discuss Otsar Beistin, which may permit guarding it as well. We'll talk about that. But I'm skipping the issue of whether it was guarded or worked, because in the end it doesn't affect us on our end. Number three, I guess, among the topics is, if it's really subject to the laws of Shemitah, you're not supposed to export it. That's one of the rules of Shemitah. If you take a look at source number 14, it's a Mishnah that begins, Ein motzi in shemen sreifa uperushvi es meha aretz l'chutzala aretz. Shemen sreifa is oil that is truma oil that has become impure, that's become tame, and now needs to be burned. That's not supposed to leave Israel, for reasons that are separate from our discussion right now. And Shemitah produce is also not supposed to leave the land of Israel. So if it's not supposed to leave the land of Israel, are we going to have a problem? So the Chazon Ish says no. If you take a look at source number 15, the Chazon Ish dealt with this in the context of Esrog, and he wrote, Vim sholchem es ha-esrogin l'chul, if they send Esrogim outside of Israel, yesh bazeh mishum ein motzi en perish vias l'chutz al-aretz, this is indeed a violation of the rule against exporting Shemitah produce. Umikomakom ein ha-peros ne'esarin v'yotzin ba'en. But it doesn't become prohibited, and you can indeed fulfill the mitzvah with them. There are also, people have letters from the Chazon Ish suggesting that if that's the only way people are going to be able to do the mitzvah, you need these Israeli esrogim, that it may be justified as well in that context for it to be exported. But even without that, Chazon Ish says the end result is going to be fine. I will note, source number 16, the Rambam, based on a Yerushalmi, writes, Peros ha'aretz sheyatzu l'chutz la'aretz misbarim b'mekoman v'lo yavirei mimakom l'makom. He says Shemitah produce that leaves Israel should be destroyed where it is. And what he's talking about is not really destruction. We'll get to this later in the Shir, but it's something called Bi'ur that has to happen at the end of the Shemitah year. He says, you take care of this Bi'ur process where it is. V'lo ya'avirei mimakom l'makom. You're not supposed to move it from one place to another. So that would be a concern. If this really is subject to the sanctity of Shemitah, it means I can't take it from place to place. So for example, let's say I am going to be in Toronto for the first days of Sukkot, and I have my Shemitah Esrog, and then I'm planning on going to New York for let's say the end of Yantav, and I want to take it with me. And I solve all the TSA problems and all the quarantine problems, and I print out all my disclaimers that will allow me to get it across the border. However, they're going to stop me at the border and say, you're not allowed. It has Kiddush Shemitah. It's a Shemitah Esrog. And you can't take it mimakom lamakom, from one place to another. There's some discussion as to what one place to another means. I saw an article by Michael Zilberman, which I'm going to quote later on, in which he quoted Rav Nissim Karelitz as saying that it's outside of the tchum, maybe what beyond the border, from one place to another means. But that would be a concern as well. I'm really just mentioning these many issues, the issue of guarding, working, exporting, because I want to get to the larger ones. I'm sort of only mentioning these in brief. But the point that comes out of these many issues is I do not need to worry about the fact that maybe it was worked and guarded. The exporter probably should not have exported it. However, having exported it, it's fine for me to use it. That's the basic principle. Now, that brings us to the second of our major issues, which is, how do I purchase this esrog? If it in fact is a Shemitah esrog, I have a problem. We already saw back in source number 1 that we said, if your esrog is a Shemitah esrog, you're not allowed to buy it. Right? What was the suggestion of the Mishnah for how to deal with that? To give it as a gift. Right? You buy the lulav and the esrog is given as a present. Very nice of him to give it to me as a present. So why is it that I'm not allowed to actually purchase a Shemitah esrog? So there are two concerns that are involved. If you take a look at source number 17, we see one of the concerns. Hatzabat soveila atzmo. Someone who makes a living by coloring things, like coloring fabric. So he's allowed to color fabric for himself. using this produce. V'lo yitzabea b'schar, but he should not do it for pay. She'ein osim schara b'peiro shviyas, because you're not allowed to engage in business with shmita produce. Dot dot dot. V'lo yelokeach yarkos sade u'mocher b'shuk. You may not take vegetables out of the field and sell them in the market. Aval hulokate ubeno mocher al yado. But you can collect them, and then your son can sell it right next to you. Why is that any different? We have to see. Lokach la'atzmo v'hosir mutter l'mocheran. If you collect it for yourself, and then you had extra, you are allowed to sell that. So this source is somewhat perplexing in terms of what it's permitting and what it is prohibiting. But what we do see here is that there's an idea of not engaging in commerce with Shemitah produce. Similarly, take a look please at source number 18. Gemara Avodah Zarah. Hachamarin shayu osin malacha b'peiro shviyas scharan shviyas. Hamarin are donkey drivers. They drive wagons. So donkey drivers who do work with Shemitah produce, what they are paid is going to have Shemitah status. So the Gemara says, what are you talking about? My scharan shviyas. What do you mean when you say that which they are paid has Shemitah status? Ilem adi avina lehu sachar mipeiro shviyas. If you're telling me that what happens is this, he is my driver. He is bringing my produce to market. Therefore, I'm going to pay him, and I'm going to give him some of the produce itself. And what you're saying is that that produce has Shemitah status. He says, how am I allowed to use my Shemitah produce to pay my driver? He says, Nimtza zep horea chovo mi peros shvias. If I'm going to allow that, then he will end up, then what that means is this fellow is paying off a debt. The debt to the donkey driver using Shemitah produce. The Torah amra le'ochla below the schara. The Torah says that it's for eating, not for marketing. And there you see in those last few words the key. That Gemara is telling us in source number 18 that since the Torah says that Shemitah produce is for you to eat, it's for you to eat, not for you to engage in commerce with. That's what you see here in source number 18. I'm not supposed to engage in commerce with Shemitah produce. Example is using it to pay my worker. In source number 19, the Gemara in Bukharos talks about using it for another commerce-related act, which is redeeming your firstborn donkey. So here are my examples of what I'm not allowed to do. Right? I'm not allowed to use Shemitah produce in order to pay a worker with it. I'm not allowed to use it to redeem my firstborn donkey. Tell me something. If you wanted to teach the Jewish people not to use Shemitah produce for commerce, are these the examples you would have used? No. What would you have used? Don't sell it. That's what I would have used as my example. Don't sell it. What are we getting these odd cases for? So take a look at source number 20, where Ramban explains what the issue of commerce really is. Ramban says, V'taima de milsa, de davar haroi la'achila, ho'il v'nispas b'kedusha shviyas, v'efshar linog bo kedusha shviyas mutar. Aval damim she'i efshar linog bem kedusha shviyas, gion chaluk asur. Ramban says, I'm allowed to trade my Shemitah produce for food, because I'll get food back, and the food can be used for Shemitah purposes, which is to say, for eating. What I'm not supposed to do is convert my Shemitah produce, which could be eaten, into money, or into clothing, I should say. He says, into clothing, which would be prohibited. Because then you, in a sense, remove it from its Kedusha, and you're not going to eat the end result. So what Ramban says is, the cases we brought in the Gemara were specific. I can't use it to pay the worker. Because what did I get in exchange for paying the worker? Right, I got labor. You can't eat labor. If I use it in order to redeem my firstborn donkey, donkeys aren't kosher. I can't eat the donkey. So that's why it's a problem. What I'm doing is, I am putting a halt to eating the Shemitah produce, notwithstanding the fact the original produce in these cases retains its Kedusha, retains its holiness. Doesn't matter. Sources 21 and 22 that I brought, source 21 is the beginning of a long Gemara that talks about how horrible it is for a person to engage in commerce with Shemitah produce and the ramifications of doing so. in the course of source 21, they talk about commerce with Shemitah produce as avka shel shavias. Avak. What does the word avak mean? Dust. Usually it's a term we would use for something that was not such a big concern. Calling it avka shel shavias makes it sound like this isn't the deoraisa, this is the derabanan or something lesser. However, Rashi there hastens to tell you that it's not so. Rashi in source 22 says, he says, yes, Isur HaKal Sheba, it is a low-level prohibition in terms of use of Shemitah produce. However, he says, it is a Lav Haba Michlal Aseh. The reason it's low-level is because it's a prohibition that's a result of a commandment. My commandment is use Shemitah produce properly. As a result, don't engage in commerce with it. That's a low-level type of a prohibition because the Torah didn't say explicitly, don't use it for commerce. So that's why it's a low-level prohibition. But Rashi is emphasizing that it's a deoraisa. It's a biblical prohibition, marketing Shemitah produce. You follow? That's the key point that emerges from this Rashi, is that in fact, it is a biblical prohibition. That's the point that emerges from this, is that I'm not supposed to engage in commerce, except that I have a question. Go back to source number 17. What's he doing with his son? If you're telling me you can't engage in commerce with Shemitah produce, then how is it that your son is going to stand next to you as you gather the produce, and he's going to be the one doing the selling? Why is that all right? Do you see anything within the language of source number 17 that might give you a hint? Is that what he said he's doing? You're on the last part, Lakach La'atzmo.
Yeah.
But that's not the son case. The son case ends with Mocher al Yado.
Well, the extra Zadak is
solid.
Sorry?
If you have leftovers, but the son's case doesn't sound like it's leftovers, right? Why is my son allowed to sell it next to me in the field? Or my daughter? It's not exclusive. Sorry?
It's not his.
Because it's not his. What do you mean?
I mean, it was his father's, but now he's...
Right. So Tosfos in source 23 suggests something along those lines. When he suggests that the idea is it's not called schora, it's not called the normal way of doing business if one person is doing the gathering and the other one is doing the selling. That's the answer that he offers. That's not the. I don't know if that's exactly what you meant, but that's not the normal way of doing business. Adding in another middleman. That's one approach. Another approach, which is found in source number 24, is look at the language here of where he's selling it. In source number 17, it said, "V'lo yelokeach yarko sade umocher b'shuk." Don't take the vegetables from the field and sell them in the market. Aval hu lokeit ubno mocher al yado. But he can gather it, and then his son can sell it al yado, right next to him, meaning in the field. If you sell it in an unusual place, you don't sell it in a store, it'll be all right. That's an answer that Tosfos brings. Another answer that Tosfos brings is to catch the words al yado and suggest that what he's doing is he's selling small quantities, and therefore it's all right. Three answers from Tosfos all hinge on the same point, which is that you're not doing it in the way you normally do business. If you're doing it in an unusual way, then you're okay. The Vilna Gaon has another suggestion. He notes the variation between lokeach and locate. I brought you the Gra in source number 25. And he has another way to look at it. His problem is not if you gather it to sell it, but if you buy it in order to sell it. But that's beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now. The point is that you are not allowed to sell Shemitah produce. However, based on what we see in the language in source 17, as Tosfos explains, you are allowed to sell it if you do it in a way that is not the normal way of doing business, not normal commerce. That's one point. Clear? Second point is, I have a completely different problem, which almost everybody understands as an independent issue. Money that was used to buy Shemitah produce now has Shemitah status. If I turn this money over to somebody who's not going to use it properly, I am potentially causing people to sin. They're not even going to know what the difference is between this money and that money. You can't look at it and see any difference. I give it to somebody who's going to use it improperly, which has two possible definitions, as you can see on your sheet in source 27 and source 28. One concern is that he's going to keep the money. He's going to hoard the money at the end of the year, which you're not allowed to do after the time for bitur, when you have to dispose of your shemitah produce, as we will discuss. Alternatively, our concern is he's going to spend it now. He's not going to spend it on food. So I have two considerations. Consideration number one is, I can't engage in normal commerce. And consideration number two is that I am not allowed to give Shemitah money to somebody who won't handle it properly. And if I buy an esrog from him, that money now gets Shemitah status. Got it? Clear? I'm throwing an awful lot at you very quickly. But that's the condensed version of this issue. So what do we do? How do we buy our Shemitah esrog? So does anybody remember from last Shemitah cycle? What does that mean? Right. So one piece of it that is used is what we saw way back when, in the beginning of source number one, which is to say, you said you buy everything at first, but I don't think that's what you meant. You're buying the lulav, and the esrog is thrown in for free in the deal. That's the theoretical idea that's called havla'a. The idea of havla'a meaning something that is absorbed in with other things, is that you're buying the lulav, and the esrog is simply thrown in. The Chazon Ish explains that we follow Rashi in Bechoros in his explanation of how this works. That it's not that I'm giving money for both of them simultaneously and just getting them together, it's that I'm paying for the lulav. Rashi in Bechoros, Lamed Aleph in the Beis, says the value of the esrog is so little it just gets absorbed in. Which, of course, you know, maybe was good for Rashi in Bechoros, but you kind of look at it nowadays and you have to wonder. It also is insufficient as an answer. That answer will only help in terms of the purchase. That answer will not help in terms of being able to harvest all the fruit. In other words, what you're telling me is, I am doing my purchase, but I'm not really buying it. That's great. But how did they harvest the whole field and keep people away from getting the produce? Who gave them the right to do that? How did they work it, if they did, in fact, work it? What was their heter for doing everything until now? Right? If the fact that I'm doing this only solves my immediate transaction. It doesn't take care of everything else. So for everything else, we have something called Otzer Beis Din. Otzer Beis Din literally means the storage of the rabbinical court. And this is something we discussed in the Midrash of Yom Rishon last month, and for those who were there, so you get a review now. But if you take a look on your sheet at source number, flip the page, 29. This is a Tosefta. It's a source going all the way back to the time of the Mishnah. It says the following. Barishona, in the beginning, we don't know when in the beginning was, we'll come back to that. Barishona, Hayushluche based in Yoshman al Pisre Ayaros, the emissaries, the proxies of the rabbinical court would stand at the entrances to the cities as people would come in from the fields. Kalmisha may be peros besochia, though people brought in produce, no lenos any manu, they would take it from them. Venos in lo mehen mizon shalosh seudos, and they would give him food for 3 meals worth. That was what you were allowed to gather from the field. Vashar machnisin oso lo otso she lo otso shebeir. The rest they would put into a storehouse in the city. Higiyas man to einim, the time came for the figs. Shluchei based in Sochrin Powelin, then the emissaries of the court would hire workers, Odrin or Orin, depending on your edition, but it's understood to me they would harvest the figs. Ve'osin oso devela, osan devela, they would make fig cakes out of it, ve'konsin osan b'chavios, and they would put them in barrels, ve'machnisin oso la'otzer sheba'ir, and they would put it into the storehouse in the city. Then Higiyas man anavim, the time for the grapes came, and so on. Just like Parshas Miketz, every Friday they would distribute the produce to the families around the city, and that way they would have the food that they would need. That's a solution called Otzer Beis Din. To unpack it and make it a little bit broader and explain what they're doing, the Beis Din would pay people to do the work. Right? They said Sochrin. They would hire people to do the work of harvesting the produce. We do not know from this source how they got their money, where their money came from to be able to do this. But that's what they would do. Now, this practice only works for the following things. It only works for tree fruit and for vegetables that took root before the Shemitah year began. Because we have a separate rabbinic prohibition against eating what are called sfichin, things that grow wildly during Shemitah. That's a discussion that's beyond the pale of our shiur today. But that's what it would work for. And so, theoretically, this could work for your esrog. Why does this work? Why is Beis Din allowed to do this? Normally, you're not allowed to harvest everything in your field. So the Chazon Ish explains, I believe I brought a piece of it there, yeah, in source number 30. He says the prohibition against harvesting your entire field is not a prohibition against harvesting per se. Rather, the prohibition is against acting as an owner. So non-owners, the Beis Din, are perfectly able to come in and take everything from the field because they're not the owners of the field. So therefore, their act of harvesting does not demonstrate ownership. Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach disagrees in his Ma'adanei Eretz, Zayin Dalet, he disagrees with this explanation, but that's the Chazon Ish's approach to it. So there are a few challenges that people bring to this idea that Beis Din gets to walk in and harvest everything. One challenge is that it looks like a joke. Right? Now it makes everything look like what happens during a normal year. Beis Din goes into the field, and they harvest everything, and they take it out of the field, and in the end, it's actually going to get marketed, as we're going to see. So that's one objection to it. Nonetheless, if the Tosefta brings it, that means it has some significance to it. You can't just say, well, I don't like this, it looks funny. The second objection, brought by Radvaz, in source number 31, is that the Rambam didn't mention this as halacha. The Rambam in his Mishnah Torah does not mention this practice of Otzer Beis Din at all. Usually, if the Rambam thinks something is halacha, he mentions it, and so Radvaz, back in the 15th, 16th century, concluded that in fact this isn't halacha. Or maybe it was for the time of the Beis HaMikdash specifically, when it said Barishona, at first they did it, it made sense at the time of the Beis HaMikdash. And one reason why would be the following. When you do this, Beis Din now collects everything for this Otzer Beis Din, right? Today, Beis Din isn't distributing what they collect to everybody on every Friday. What does Beis Din do with this Otzer Beis Din? They sell it. They turn around and market it. And the way they do it is the produce still has Kedusha Shvius. It's still holy. You can't just go sell it. So what they do is, they tell you, we're not making a profit. All we want is to make back the expenditure for the people who were working to collect everything and, you know, package it and bring it to market, and the time involved of all the people who coordinated everything. So what we are going to do is we're going to charge you for this bottle of wine for labor. Labor. We're not charging you for parts. We're just charging you for labor. That's the basic idea of how Beis Din is doing it. So Rav Rimon suggests that maybe that's why Radbaz says this worked in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. Because in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, it would look different, because how did Beis Din get paid? Exactly. Trumas HaLishka. Beis Din would get paid out of the excess half shekel. Whereas today, Beis Din is being paid by people who are taking the produce from them. Right? It looks an awful lot like commerce. So that may be one explanation for why it was good in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, but it wouldn't be good thereafter. Others disagree and say no. The reason why the Rambam omitted it is because it doesn't involve any great novelties. If the rule is as simple as you're allowed to harvest, just don't act as an owner, and Beis Din isn't acting as an owner, so there's no great novelty to what's being done here, and therefore the Rambam didn't need to mention this as an interesting historical nuance. The halacha was already there. Others say, even if the Rambam disagrees with this practice, you can still use it because Ramban, the Rosh Mishans on a Mishnah in the 9th chapter of Shviyas as well, they quote it. And if the Rambam disagrees, especially today when Shemitah is rabbinic, we may not paskin like the Rambam. And therefore we could use the Otzer Beis Din. Another point that's brought in is the fact that certainly those who do rely on Otzer Beis Din, meaning the Beis Din that's doing this, they certainly have rabbinic authorities to depend on. So Rabbi Ben Tzion Abba Shaul in his Or LeTzion says, even if I don't like it, those who are doing it have a basis for what they're doing, and therefore I would be allowed to buy from them, and it wouldn't be called putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. But the second objection is, Rambam didn't mention it. The third objection is that the Beis Din in that story did the distribution. They didn't sell it in stores. We said you can't sell it derech schora in the normal way of doing business. So indeed, what you will see is that Otzer Beis Din will be sold in a special stand often. It won't be in a regular store. In order to try to distinguish, some specifically require a separate stand. So what happens today is the Beis Din will go in there. The Beis Din will hire workers. Often they will hire the farmer himself, because the farmer himself is the one who knows his own field the best. And they'll hire the normal workers, adding fuel to those who say, well, the whole thing is a joke, right? And to some specifically, Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli or Mordechai Eliyahu did not like that. But that's what Beis Din will often do, is they'll hire the farmers. They may or may not keep people out as they do this, depending on whom they follow, on whether you're allowed to keep people out. They may do work to maintain the field, according to some. Rav Kook did not like that idea. But the basic idea is, they will gather everything, they will run the production line, they will bring it to market, and the consumer is going to pay for the Beis Din's labor and their outlay of funds. Clear? That's your Otzer Beis Din. So, when I get my Shemitah Esrog, it is done via Otzer Beis Din. And I am paying, if I'm paying for it, I am paying for the work that was done. The third point, and here we're about to reach the 1 hour mark, and if people have to go, it's understood, but I'm going to try to be brief with the third point, is the question of what happens after Sukkot is over. In source number 32, I referred you to a very good article by Michal Zilberman, and actually I was in touch with him about a couple of points in his article, and he informed me that it's also found in a sefer that he published on Maseches Sukkah. Tov Lev is the name of the sefer, published with YU Press. So you can see the article in the Hebrew there. The article on the website is actually in English. But there are two issues that come up after Sukkot is over. One is the mitzvah of Biur, which I mentioned before. The mitzvah of Biur is brought in source number 33 and in the Ramban in source number 34, is that at the end of Shemitah, I am supposed to get rid of my produce, my Shemitah produce. We don't want people hoarding Shemitah produce. When Shemitah produce disappears from the field, from the orchard, from the vegetables, whatever it is, at that point I have to get rid of it. Ramban explains in source 34, this subject to some debate, but Ramban's position, which we tend to follow, is that biur doesn't mean destroying it. It's not biur chametz. It doesn't mean destruction of the produce. It means getting it out of your possession. So you have to make it hefker, take it outside of your house, and leave it there for somebody else. So that's problem number one, is making sure that I do my biur. When is the date for biur for esrogim? So I've seen different dates. I've seen the middle of Iyar. I've seen Shvat. I've seen Tammuz. It's clearly long after Sukkot, so you're fine on Sukkot. But you have to worry about doing biur afterwards. That's one concern. The second concern is that we have a rule with Shemitah produce that you're not allowed to destroy it. Rabbi Heber alluded to it before. I'm not allowed to destroy Shemitah produce. So even though normally when we dispose of a mitzvah item, we dispose of it respectfully, but I can't dispose of it. So now what am I supposed to do with my esrog afterwards? You are allowed to cook with Shemitah produce, but what am I going to do with the peel? Let's say I want to make jam out of the esrog itself. What am I going to do with the peel? Is it animal food? Is it human food? So how do we deal with this? So again, to make a long story short, and I'm going to abbreviate remarks on this, the easiest and simplest way to deal with it is simply to let the esrog go bad. Much like when you separate truma outside of Eretz Yisrael and you don't have a Beis Hamikdash with a Tahor Kohen to give it to. So what do? You let it go bad, and then afterwards you're allowed to dispose of it. And so that's what is recommended here. The Chazon Ish notes, I brought you the Yerushalmi for it as well, I think. I just brought you the Chazon Ish on it in source number 38. But there's no prohibition against letting something go bad. Even though I'm not allowed to actively destroy it, I can let it go bad. And I have until the time for Biur, whatever the time of Biur is going to be. I did note in Source 39 an interesting view from Rav Moshe Sternbach. Rav Moshe Sternbach contends that it's possible to argue that the time for Biur, for Esrogim, is actually the day after Sukkot. Why? Because if you own an orchard for Esrogim, you don't want to leave last year's Esrogim on the tree, draining the tree of its strength, right? It's like if you have an orchid. So after the flowers have died, you trim the stem right away because you don't want to drain the plant of its energy trying to sustain something that you don't need and want. So too here with your Esrog. They're clearing the orchard the day after Sukkot. So he says, Kala l'chayim in hasada. Now there are no more Esrogim out in the field. And therefore, perhaps that's your day for Biur. But the general tendency is not to offer the day after Sukkot as the time for Biur. And therefore, the answer is, you have until then, whether that's Shvat, or Iyar, or Tammuz, or whatever it is, you have until then for your Esrog to go bad, and generally speaking, Esrog can become inedible just by leaving them exposed to the air long before that. They dry out. So that's one possibility. There are those who suggest that you should return it to Eretz Yisrael, that you should actually bring it back to Israel. Rav Moshe Sternbach in the Shemitah Kehilchasa, the same source that I brought you in number 39, quotes Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein as recommending this procedure. However, Rabbi Zilberman noted in his article that the Kaftor Vaferach, a very old sefer on laws related to Israel, actually quotes a view that you're not supposed to bring Shemitah produce back to Eretz Yisrael. That you're not supposed to bring it back. That your beer should be done outside of Israel. So we have competing views. Plus, of course, bringing it back to Israel doesn't solve your problem. They still have to be taken care of and you know, beer has to be done properly. A third approach is simply to eat them. Right? So make it into jam. And indeed, Rav Chaim Kanievsky recommends that in his Derech Emunah. He says, eat it. But there is a debate regarding the status of the peel and whether the peel go bad. It's not simple and straightforward. Plus, of course, there is also a view that you're not allowed to eat Shemitah produce outside of Eretz Yisrael. So it's a minority view, but it is in the Ravid on that Sifra that I brought in source number 33. The upshot of all of this, then, is that number one, we have an issue with our Esrog, we have an issue potentially with our Hadassim as well, according to some views. We solve the problem of purchasing using Oats or Beis Din, as well as Havlah, which I believe should be a closed box sale, although I know not everybody does it as a closed box sale. And then after Shemitah is over, it seems like the simplest solution is indeed to let it go bad. In terms of your Hadassim, then, if I have a concern for Biur, then I think probably you should not, this year, you should not take the Hadassim and grind them up and turn them into your Besamim, or let them dry out and turn them into your Besamim. I think maybe this year it's probably a good idea not to do that. I don't even know if Hadassim here come from Eretz Yisrael in any case. I think they come from Muncie. Which also has a din of Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, but I think that's the simplest solution for it. As I said at the beginning, please consult your rabbi and ask your rabbi what you ought to do with this. But hopefully, this was some help in learning the background on these issues.
Yeah.